It's been a theme of literature for, I've been told, millennial. But in the 1990s, Disney did a remake of Aladdin, and it put it back on the culture's radar. The whole story of if you rub a lamp, a genie comes out and you get three wishes. If you could ask for anything, you could ask for anything, what would you ask for? Several things flood to mind, don't they? At the top of your list, was it a life where I could simply serve everyone? The genie in a bottle still exists in our culture today, I believe. It's called Amazon Prime. Which reveals some of where we're at. Click, click, I want that. And we get it. Does anybody think first, though, of, you know, all I would ever really want is to be the servant of all? That would be the best. This summer, we're in this series called Playing With My Serve. We're looking at these two disciplines, these two rhythms of what it means to be a little bit more like Jesus, that of play and that of service. And in that, we are encouraging folks to try to initiate with other people this summer and initiate two times of play and two times of service. And if you're way behind on that, one is better than none, so you can still go for it. In our little summer challenge here, we've heard some encouraging stories about that. But when we look at what we really want, what we could ask for, if we could ask for anything, we'll see in today's passage that Jesus teaches us what we think we want and what we ultimately want are sometimes two different types of things. When he gives us his ultimate line of, I didn't come here to be served, but to serve. That was his drive. That was his motivation. Church, this morning I'm going to be reading right now from the book of Matthew. As you remember, Matthew is one of Jesus' disciples whose name used to be Levi. Because when somebody would have asked Levi in his early days, hey, what do you really want? He would have said, more money. He was a tax collector, we remember, who made his money off of ripping off his own people and was viewed as a traitor and didn't care because it made him filthy rich. But then he encountered Jesus and saw that giving was far better than receiving. I'm going to be reading from Matthew chapter 20, verses 20 through 28. If you would and you are able, please stand for the reading of God's word. Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked a favor of him. And he said to her, what do you want? She said to him, declare that these two sons of mine will sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom. But Jesus answered, don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? They said to him, we are able. He said to them, you will indeed drink my cup, but to sit at my right and at my left, this is not mine to grant, but it is for those whom it has been prepared by my Father. When the ten heard it, they were angry with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. It will not be so among you, but whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be your slave, just as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life is a ransom for many. Amen. You may have a seat. When the question comes through to Jesus to sit at his right hand or his left, what mom is asking for here is for her own greatness to, and the greatness of her children. The right and the left hand was simply a way of saying the power positions. This is what I want most, is that my kids, my two boys, would be in the prime spots, and that I, by a mother, then would be reflected within that. She's asking for greatness. She's asking for power as the world understands it. Later on there in verse 25, Jesus explains to her what she's asking. You're looking for it this way. The rulers of this world, the people that we call great, are people who have power over other people, who lord it over them, who are tyrants. Power in that sense, defined like this. When somebody has power, they tell someone else what to do, and by power, they can force them to do it. Telling somebody else what to do, and you have the power to enforce it. That's one part of power. The other part of power is when there's a conflictual situation, a tension, the person who has power is the one who is able to walk away from the tension. Let me explain. If you think of an extreme example, like an inmate and a guard in jail, if they're having a bad day and neither of them want to be a part of the situation, the guard can say, I'm done with this. I don't need this in my life anymore. And take a sick day the next day and not be there. Or pursue a different career entirely. The inmate can't. They don't have any power. When we're trying to figure out who has the power, we can look for those two things. That they would have the ability to enforce what they say, even if the other person doesn't want to do it, and the ability to walk away. I don't want to be a part of this anymore, so I'm simply going to move away from this and be something different than the situation is calling for. All 12 of them wanted this type of power. The two asked for it, and Mark, it has them directly asking for it, but all 10 wanted it. You can tell that because they started grumbling, right? They got angry at the other because they were getting what the other two might be getting, exactly what they wanted, and so they start to become angry with them. I want to use a central analogy here as we talk about these concepts of what they want and what it is that Jesus will give him. What they want can be looked at like fast food. Like, I'm going to pick on today Carl's Jr. I'm going to pick on Carl's Jr. because it, on most lists, turns out to be one of the most unhealthy places you can order fast food. And I've never really liked Carl's Jr.'s. I have plenty of fast food weaknesses, but that's not one of them. Carl's Jr., you could say these people wanted power. They wanted Carl's Jr.'s. Why? Because it tastes good in your mouth and it is in your belly really, really fast. So wanting power and greatness like that is similar to wanting fast food. And similar to that, Jesus is responding with this counterintuitive notion. He's saying, no, what you actually want, what greatness really is, where power really is you want a garden. What you want is to raise a garden, which counterintuitively requires so much more of you. It requires planning, requires soil amendment, it requires planting, it requires maintenance, it requires irrigation, it requires harvesting, it requires pruning, it requires food prep. It requires so much more than does ordering a meal from a place like Carl's Jr.'s. Why do they want this? Why are the disciples asking for this type of Carl's Jr.? What are they looking for here? Well, we have to recognize that in the culture at the time, they were surrounded by one explanation, one concept of what greatness or power was. There wasn't alternative ideas to what greatness or power could look like for them. And so this was their desire. They were surrounded by the concept. Each one of us likes to think that we're choosing our own destiny. But in reality, most of us are operating most of the day soaked in the ideas of the particular cultures that we've lived in, because that's how most learning occurs. We learn by what's going on around us, what the big people are doing around us, what those who we esteem and value, what they give their time and energy to, is often what we end up doing. And the disciples only saw one use of power and one explanation of greatness. They were surrounded by these concepts and couldn't think outside of those ideas. And so they adopted those ideas. We were remembering, why do they want this Carl's Jr. power? Well, what they're seeing is there's two options. They are a colonized people, is the nation of Israel at this point, by Rome. They were conquered by them, and so they are oppressed. And power is either you are the oppressor or you are the oppressee, and we'd rather have a shot at being the oppressor, because those are the only two options. And so that's why they are driving for it. Why do they want this Carl's Jr. instead of the garden? Well, they're still living in an ignorance there. This is the third time in the sentences previous to this story. This is the third time Jesus has told them, I'm going to Jerusalem. I will be turned over. I will suffer and I will die on a cross and then raised in 3 days. He's told them this three times so far and they have zero clue. And he's getting close to this moment. They have no understanding of what it is that this means in their own lives, let alone in his life. So they do not understand what his passion, his whole main purpose is. And we recognize that in their lack of understanding, and so their participation in sin, is that they're not shaking their fists in rebellion. This is a key to understand. They're not shaking their fists in rebellion to Jesus. They just don't get it. They just don't understand. And so they're pursuing a different way of life. They don't understand what it is that he's doing. It's not that they're shaking their fists. And this is so often where we are off track. Most of our lives that is sin, that is destructive, isn't because we're shaking our fists in rebellion. It's because we're still clueless. And we don't quite understand. This is the story in Genesis 1 and 2 in the garden. Adam and Eve are not shaking their fists in rebellion against God. They're simply adopting an alternative idea to what God gave them. Oh, that we could know the difference between good and evil? Oh, okay. They weren't shaking their fists in rebellion. They were just in their own ignorance accepting some of an alternative idea. Why were they pursuing this Carl's Jr.'s type of living? Well, in their ignorance, they were disillusioned about who they were. That is, they didn't have great self-awareness. They didn't know what their actual lives were doing to other people and what they were capable of. Jesus says to them, you know, are you able to drink this cup? Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink? And they said, we are able. We are able. They said, we are able to drink your cup. In other words, bring it on. We're with you and we will go the limits with you. We will go all the way with you. Those who know what is in the cup that Jesus is asking them to drink don't want to have anything to do with it. Jesus did not want to drink the cup. He was in the garden the night before he died and he said, Father, if there's any way, make this cup pass. I don't want this. Those who know what's in the cup don't want to have anything to do with the cup. About 2 decades ago. No, 1.5. at the time, the Evangelical Covenant Church of Fort Collins, Colorado, said, hey, Bert, do you want to be the lead pastor? And I said, sure. I had no idea what the costs would be, what the demands would be. And then if I knew, I would have said, no. And hopefully I would have got to the place where I could have said, but it's not my will, it's yours. So if you want this, let's do this. Somehow you will provide a way. We are most of the time terrible at assessing our own ability. We either shoot way too high or go way too low. This guy wrote a great book from this year. His name is Greg Ten Elsloff. He's a professor down at Biola in Southern California, and he's been teaching there for over a decade or so. And he mentions that, you know, in my finer moments, I don't really need to be in a state of false humility with anybody. I work really hard at my job, and I think I'm a little better than average as a professor. And he said, I'm in good company, because in a recent survey done of college professors, 94% of them would rank themselves as better than average. In a recent study done with a million high school students were asked a series of questions. 70% of them said they are above average leaders. Okay, 70% of them thought they were above average leaders. And then when they were asked the question, rank your ability on being able to get along with other people, 100% of them said they were better than average. 100% of them said they were better than average. 60% of them thought that they were in the top 10% of being able to get along with others. And 25% of them said they were in the top 1%. Clearly, we're not good at assessing ourselves. Can you drink this cup? We are able. We either shoot too high or we go too low. It's a good thing I'm good at self-assessment, though. He's asking for their humility. He's trying to paint a different picture. He's trying to give them a vision of what's going on. Why is it that they wanted this Carl's Jr.'s type of lifestyle? Well, they thought what they were pursuing would give them what they wanted. Church, that's what every sin's lie is. We don't do sin. We don't deviate from the path of God because we think it'll ruin our lives. We deviate because we think this will give me what I want, what I need. And that's why we go there. And that's what they were doing. Each sin tells us a little bit of a lie, and we believe that lie and go after it, which is why they wanted Carl's Jr.'s. I'm hungry. This will satisfy me. This will give me what I want. Now, what we need to see here about Jesus' response to them is a number of different things in Jesus' response. At the core, Jesus is trying to affirm to them this desire that you have that is driving you to this place to ask this question, to want these things, is actually a good desire. It's just trying to be fulfilled in the wrong way. Church, when you're standing at line at Carl's Jr.'s, okay, and you're right about to order what is considered by some list as the most unhealthy burger, the Monster Burger. It has 1,330 calories and 95 grams of fat. Hella, that looks good though. When you're standing there and you're going to order the large fries and the refillable Coke, Jesus is trying to tell us, look, the desire to fill your belly is a great and good thing. You're just going about it the wrong way. This desire to be great, this desire to have influence, it's a great thing. You're just thinking about it in the wrong way. We need you to think about it in a different way. That's how all sin is. If somebody's given to gossip, say, that desire for intimacy and significance, which is what gossip provides for us, I feel connected to you now. I feel like I've got something terrific to offer to you now. The desire for significance and connection, intimacy, is a beautiful thing, but gossip is going about it the wrong way. For those of us given to drink too much alcohol, you know, to abuse that, people, the desire for peace is a good thing. The desire to connect with others is a good thing. Just going about it the wrong way that is not sustainable and will only lead to destruction. Our desire, Jesus is trying to teach us in this story, is a good thing. How we're going about it the wrong way. What do we want? We want to sit at your right and your left hand. But you're going about it, thinking about it the wrong way, and it will only bring to your destruction. What we can also see in this is that Jesus' response to them is the desire that they have, this temptation that they have to rule like the Gentiles rule. That's not the sin. All right, Jesus was tempted in the wilderness for that time before he got into public ministry. He was tempted to do those things that the enemy was asking him to do. You being tempted to do those deviant type of things isn't the sin. You need to let yourself off the hook on that. You will always desire wrong things. There's a battle inside of you. You will always desire those things. The temptation itself is not the sin. And Jesus is attempting to show them that here. And so it's good when you've got your go-tos. Each of our personality has particular go-to sin mechanisms where we're trying to get something. It's good to explore that. What am I really after here? What is it that I want that I think that this is going to give me? Jesus in his response is also showing us he is a huge God who can handle our desires. When James and John's mother come to him and he asks them, what do you want? They basically telling him, I want to be great. I want to be powerful. Jesus doesn't flip out. He doesn't get frustrated with where they are. It's almost like he expects it. And is able to grab them where they are, not be frustrated with where they are, but recognize, no, they're still growing. The good gardener doesn't get frustrated because the almond tree is growing out of proportion some different ways. That's what growing things do. Some branches grow longer, some not quite, some in the wrong directions. The gardener doesn't get upset because the tree is doing that. The gardener prunes. Because the gardener knows this is where the tree is at. So I can receive that and then offer the correction to make it produce more fruit. Because if I let it go, it will only bring destruction. It will only bring destruction. And we see some of that destruction already showing up. As the 12 are functioning in their own ignorance, and the destruction of the sin is already underway. You see it there because the disciples are getting angry with one another because they all want the same thing. And in this, Jesus is responding not the way the world responds. When we see competition for sacred resources, what we believe, normally what our world teaches us is divide into your camp, to your tribe, and throw grenades at the other side. But what happens when we divide ourselves into our own tribe, we only see the other tribe as a caricature and not true. Jesus does this beautiful thing in this passage, and he calls them to him. Jesus calls them to him. He brings the 10, he brings the 2 together, and he offers a different vision for what can be. Because when we get close to those who we are angry with, and we allow ourselves to see them, we see that they too bear the very image of God. And we can see God working in them and are able to find a new way through. And that's what Jesus is doing here in his response to them as they become angry. He's pulling them together. And so Jesus is telling us, so grow your garden. Grow your garden. One of the most powerful figures, I believe, in the story of Christianity is Jesus' cousin John the Baptist. If you remember some of his lifestyle, he ate locusts and honey. He lived in the wilderness alone, camel hair, leather belt. And not only that, but the type of conflict that man initiated and endured is striking. And so we see him oftentimes as a strong and powerful character, but the surprise is the way that he describes himself. The surprise is the way he describes himself as a way of joy. In one particular passage, John and his disciples and Jesus and his disciples are both at the Jordan River baptizing people. And John's disciples come to John and say, hey, the one that you were testifying about, everybody's going to him now. In other words, he's winning. He's got more people. The momentum seems to be shifting that way. I want to read the passage for you. In John 3, it says, they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, the one who was with you across the Jordan, to whom you testified, here he is baptizing, and all are going to him. John answered, "No one can receive anything except what has been given from heaven. You yourself are my witnesses that I said, I'm not the Messiah, but I have been sent ahead of him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. For this reason, my joy has been fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease." John is experiencing the kingdom of God in this way. He's living the words of Jesus. I'm not here to be served. I'm here to serve. And in that, I'm finding the greatest joy. He's comparing it to this whole wedding. I'm not the groom. I'm not the bride. I'm kind of more like the best man. None of this is about me. I'm here to serve this whole situation. And so when I see the groom, my man, having the time of his life, that's what gives me joy. And to know that I got to play some simple part in that, some influence to help this whole thing go really well, that really is what is ringing my bell. I must decrease at this wedding. It's not about me. He must increase. It is about him. It's a great relief to know that we don't have to control everything, that we don't have to lead everything, that the Messiah is the one who can do that. John the Baptist knew where power was and what to do with it. He knew that gardening was better than Carl's Jr.'s. Franciscan priest Richard Rohr tells the story of one time when he was hosting a retreat in Australia for some of the Aborigine people. And they wanted to hold this particular retreat at a place called, at one of their sacred spots called Konjanup. I believe is how you say that. And translated, that means the place of the stone axe. The story runs that centuries back, the Aborigine people would take their young sons and they would bring them to this place where there was a lot of flint rock. And they would run them through a series of initiation activities to prove themselves ready to be a man and carry their own axe. And if they passed the tests, and the way that they defined this was, were they able to show themselves teachable? Were they able to handle power the only way it should be handled, for the common good? If they could show themselves teachable and able to use power for the common good, not their own advancement, then they were given the honor and privilege of grabbing the flint rock and building their own axe. when the English and the Irish settlers came, they didn't understand all this. And so in the name of efficiency and productivity, they simply handed out axes to every young man. They tell the stories of how that wreaked havoc, both on the ecosystem and the culture. When people received power before they knew what to do with it, they used it for themselves and not for the common good. They say that they still have issues with this in their culture today. We can only handle power, greatness, when we know that it is for others. That is when we are serving, when we're giving away for ourselves. The servant position is, in fact, the power position. If we define power and greatness in a different way. One of my favorite Thomas Merton quotes that still undoes me is, he says this quite simply: our Christian destiny is, in fact, a great one. But to achieve it, you must lose all interest in becoming great. Our Christian destiny is, in fact, a great one. But to achieve it, you must lose all interest in becoming great. Napoleon Bonaparte said something quite similar to that. He, in mourning how his own influence couldn't stretch longer than it did, Napoleon says, "Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and myself founded empires. But on what did we rest the creation of our genius? Upon sheer force. Jesus Christ alone founded his empire upon love, and at this hour, millions of men will die for him." Who had the power? Who had the greatness? Those who used force or those who served with love? One of my favorite characters is this man named Henry Nouwen. He tells the story of, after he left the Ivy Leagues to teach, he went to an adults with special needs community called Daybreak. And there he met a special friend named Trevor. And at one point, Trevor had to be moved to a different facility, and Henry would often go and visit him. And on one of his visits to go see his friend Trevor, Trevor said, "Hey, why don't we invite some of the priests around here and some of the hospital staff, and we'll have a big luncheon." And Henry said, "That's a great idea." So when Henry showed up on the day of the given luncheon, he was met by one of the hospital staff and said, "Hey, I'm here for this luncheon, I guess for me and with Trevor and all of our friends. Can I go sit next to Trevor now?" And the man responded to him and said, "Yeah, Trevor won't be in this luncheon. Our staff and our patients never eat together. It's our policy. And besides all of that, we have reserved the golden room. And a patient has never been in the golden room." Henry responded to him with a bit of a surprise, saying, "Well, then I won't be going either. The only reason that I'm here is to have lunch with my friend Trevor." And so a bunch of scurrying happened and this and that. And they say, "Well, we pulled some strings and Trevor could come in." Henry describes the lunch this way. He says, "You know, it was one of those quiet lunches where most people didn't know each other, so they were getting acquainted, and everybody was being very sophisticated and calm and asking reasonable questions until Trevor stood up. And he lifted his glass of Coke and he says, 'A toast to Henry!'" Nobody knew what to do with the situation, not knowing it was coming, and so Trevor instructed them, "Lift your glass!" And they all obeyed. "A toast to Henry." And as if it was as natural as the next thing he could do, he started to sing, "If you're happy and you know it, lift your glass. If you're happy and you know it, lift your glass." Henry describes this scene as in less than a few minutes, everybody was standing and belting it out. "If you're happy and you know it, then your face will surely show. If you're happy and you know it, lift your glass." The one with the least amount of power influenced that room, changed the dynamics entirely. The servant position is the power position. We will be great if we lose interest in being great in the way that this world describes it. Church, what do you want? You want to be great? Can you drink the cup? Do we want to be served? Eat that Carl's Jr.? Or to serve? Can we trust that the garden is better? That it is how we are designed? Jesus' whole life was an emphasis on this. Even on the very last Passover meal that he was serving together, he gathered his disciples. He broke the bread. He poured out the cup. He washed their feet and told them, "Now go and wash others' feet." He gave his blood shed for the forgiveness of the sins. One of the greatest privileges of being in leadership here at this church is serving communion. Virtually everyone I've ever talked to who served communion here says it's so much more beautiful to serve it than to receive it. So this morning we want to try something a little bit different as we approach the table. Instead of having our council or staff serve, we're going to have three stations. We're going to ask, and this is going to take a little bit longer. It's going to be a little bit more of a linger moment. But come up and serve each other. There are no magic words for how this gets done. You can simply say, "This is God's body and his blood for you." And tear off a piece of the bread, dip it into the cup, and receive his life. Each one of the stations will have a gluten-free option. Those are the cut-up breads. The glass cup has wine. The other cup, the silver cup, has juice in it. Church, you're invited. All followers of Christ are warmly invited to receive his bread, to drink his cup. This time, let's serve one another. In the name of Jesus, amen.